and we got new extended speakers here. The first case for argument is Gates versus Towery. Mr. Henriquez?
May it please the court. It is the law in this circuit that when tenders of complete relief are made to the named plaintiffs before a class is certified, indeed when a motion for class certification is not even pending, those tenders will moot not only the individual claims, but also the claims brought on behalf of a putative class. And in this case, no class had been certified and no motion for class certification was pending when the tenders were made to the two named plaintiffs.
But in what sense was the tender complete when it didn't include interest, compensatory damages, even nominal, or costs?
Well, it was complete because the letters that accompanied the checks that returned the money that had been taken from both arrestees at the time of their arrests agreed to pay.
A letter promising to pay complete relief later is not complete relief now. We know, having had to sit en banc through it, how hard it can be to collect debts from the city of Chicago. So a letter obviously is not interest. A check might be interest, but a letter is not.
Well,
but I'm also interested in the lack of any attempt to tender damages, because we know from Kerry against Pippas that somebody whose due process rights are violated is entitled at least to nominal damages, and there was no tender of costs. We can put attorney's fees to one side, but you have to tender the costs of suit. Right? Rule 68 lists the kind of things you've got to do in order to resolve cases, and the city's offer just didn't do it.
Well, the with respect to interest, to return to that for a second, as we point out in our brief, there's a state statute that governing public fund investments.
State statutes lose to the Constitution of the United States. If the Constitution requires interest, the plaintiffs say it does, and there's a lot of legal authority for the proposition that full compensation in constitutional claims includes interest, state statutes are neither here nor there.
Well, the property interest, it would be required by their constitutional claim of due process. There must be a property interest, and of course that the property interest is defined by state law, and that statute that we refer to indicates that there is no property interest in interest on the amount that had been taken from them at the time of their arrest.
Look, I can't believe you're making this argument. This was money in their pockets for the city of Chicago to say that that is not property within the meaning of the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution is ludicrous.
Well, we stand on the brief with respect to the issue of whether that is whether there was a property interest in this case. Let me move to the other part of your question, which was consequential damages. As we point out in the brief, they had an opportunity in connection with their class certification motion, in which we defended on the ground that there was no justiciability of this claim. They had an opportunity at that point to present any evidence they wished that there were any consequential damages flowing to either of the named plaintiffs or any other class member, and they refused to do that.
You're not responding to my question. I was very careful to talk about nominal damages. You don't have to prove up nominal damages. They're what you get if you can't show other forms of injury. But the city's tender did not include even a buck for nominal damages.
Well, they've tried to characterize the return of the money that had been taken from them at the time of their arrest as something other than damages. That was damages that was taken from them. So was that constituted the damages in the case. So we wouldn't have to present any nominal damages on top of something that already is damages, Your Honor.
I think it's clear from this conversation that full relief has not been tendered in this case. You certainly have not satisfied their claims. You haven't satisfied me. I mean, how can this make a case moot when there's still something to argue about, which is about what what, in fact, they're entitled to.
Well, we certainly believe that in our briefs we did.
Look, you cannot take the position that if a defendant pays whatever the defendant thinks is due, a case necessarily becomes moot, even if the plaintiff wants more. But that seems to be the position you're taking, that when the defendant tenders everything the defendant concedes is due, the lawsuit has to be dismissed.
Well, there was a focus on exactly what the plaintiff believed was due at the time of the motion for class certification.
What's the city's current policy of returning seized property and notifying arrestees about their rights to have property returned?
You know, the current policy that is the current policy is that if an arrestee, once released from arrest, does not obtain all the property that he submitted at the time of the arrest, then any remaining property he's advised to get through the criminal court, where where that property is supposed to be, where orders concerning that property are supposed to be made. So that's how the person would get their property back.
You know, the city had this inventory form that erroneously told arrestees that they would be notified when the seized property would be available. And I really find it alarming, I must say, that the reply brief dismisses this language as surplusage and says essentially, in any event, a lawyer could figure it out. I mean, aside from the fact that we're talking about $20, $80, $110, whatever. Suppose a form had said, we have the right to require forfeiture of your property without due process. Under your reasoning, that's mere surplusage as well, since the criminal court, as you just noted, is in charge of property and makes the decisions regarding forfeiture.
Well,
and in any event, you seem to think arrestees are entitled to counsel who could tell them their rights regarding forfeiture. I mean, does this seem right to you?
Well, Your Honor, we certainly rethought the issue once this case was filed, but we don't think that there was any legal violation here, much less a due process violation. After all, the notice that the inventory receipt that arrestees received did not tell them that they would be notified by the city that their property was available. Property would be available through the criminal court, and they have lawyers who should be able to learn and notify their clients that the property at some point would be available once it's no longer needed as evidence or no longer subject to forfeiture. So, you know, while we learned from this lawsuit that people might be misled into believing that that somehow they would get a notification from the city, which the notice didn't say, and that's why we changed the notice, we don't think that there was any legal violation at all, much less the type of legal violation that remains in this case, which is a claim for procedural due process.
Suppose the city had a policy of never returning seized funds. Could it maintain this clearly unconstitutional policy, and any time an arrestee complained, simply refund money to that individual arrestee without altering the policy?
Oh, of course not. What should happen in the normal course is that the arrestee goes in through his attorney into the criminal court and gets a court order directing the city to return property that was taken from him at the time of the arrest. Once the attorney submits that order to the city, the city would have to comply with that order, otherwise go in violation of state law. If the city didn't comply with that order, then, of course, that would be enforceable through the criminal courts against the city.
The other thing I really thought was kind of odd was that the city seems to think it's more prudent for the plaintiffs to work with the city to seek reform of their property retention policy. But that isn't really something for the city to decide. I mean, it seems to me plaintiffs have the right to file suit to get the city's attention. After all, the threat of a class action and and accompanying attorney's fees is meant to keep public bodies on their toes and, wary of creating internal policy that violates citizens' rights. Isn't it? I mean, I really didn't get the thrust of that argument at all.
Well, Your Honor, our view was we did get they did get our attention, as Your Honor said, when they filed this lawsuit. And part of the relief that they requested was a change in the policy. We wished to work with them to change that policy, and that never happened. And so we ended up doing the best we could and changed the policy without their input. That's what we meant by working together to do that. And we also wanted to assist these people in getting money back, money that they say they desperately needed, and that's the reason why we tendered them the money. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, if I may.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Peters?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Tom Peters on behalf of the plaintiffs and the class. In light of the Court's comments and just Judge Easterbrook's questions to counsel about the failure to provide adequate or complete relief to the plaintiffs and the plaintiff class, let me skip to...
I don't know whether it's complete or not. And the point I was making is not what the plaintiffs were entitled to, but that in order to moot a case, the defendant has to satisfy the plaintiff's demand, rather than tender what the defendant concedes is owed. Maybe the plaintiff is demanding too much. I certainly wasn't suggesting that you're entitled to everything you demand.
Well, I certainly agree with what you just said, and I didn't mean to convey that impression. But what I would like to do is skip to the other part.
Well, I'd like to know how the plaintiffs or have the plaintiffs ever stated how much they believe they're entitled to in consequential damages for the time spent trying to track down arresting officers, time lost from work, loss of, the use of their money, etc.
No, that has never come up so far because of the procedural history of the case. Since there was the interlocutory appeal was granted at a point at which discovery in terms of depositions had just begun. In fact, no depositions had even been taken, if I recall correctly. The documentary discovery was going to be complete within a month or two, and after that there would have been discussions about consequential damages, presumably. However, because we never got to that point, there was no such discussion.
Well, the city offered prejudgment interest, didn't they?
The city offered in a letter prejudgment interest.
Doesn't that traditionally address consequential damages?
No, Your Honor.
Time spent? Wouldn't that have addressed this issue of time spent?
I do not believe that would fully compensate a plaintiff under the circumstances of this case.
Why is that?
Because if, for example, Mr. Gates suffered a loss, lost his job, or lost time out from work,
That's something that you're prepared to prove, right?
Yes. We're prepared to prove that there were actual damages resulting from the time that was wasted pursuing an utterly futile policy. But in addition to that, as long as we're on that topic, they never tendered even the costs of the suit. And that has real-world consequences here. The cost of filing suit at that time was $150. Their claims totaled about $200. So as to Mr. Nelson, he would have suffered a net loss of approximately $26 if he was compelled against his will to accept their offer. And Mr. Gates, instead of getting the $113 that he was actually owed, was only going to get about $28 or $29. So requiring somebody to accept a settlement that puts them at a net loss surely leaves an open controversy.
How do you respond to the city's claim that you failed to address the Buchanan case?
Well, first of all, Buchanan has nothing to do with the situation we're in. Buchanan would only come into play if the case itself was completely over. We have live individual claims that are still being litigated. Whether or not we're entitled to...
Well, of course, their argument is that it's all moot, and Buchanan says that once a claim is moot, a party is not entitled to attorney's fees and costs.
Of course, but that assumes that the case is moot. So their first premise is wrong. The case is not moot. We still have damages that we're entitled to. We still have costs that we're entitled to. In addition to that, I'd like to point out, with respect to the timing of this of these events, the city has it wrong. Even if there had been, according to the city, if we take their brief as true, which I don't concede that, if a motion for class certification is pending at the time of the offer, then the class representative does not lose standing. I believe the city concedes that much. In this case, what happened was there was a complaint filed by Mr. Gates. No motion for certification was immediately filed due to certain things that were going on with respect to discovery and whatever. An amended complaint was filed roughly 6 weeks later on behalf of Mr. Nelson. On the very same day, a motion for class certification was filed for Gates, Nelson, and the class. The city's offer to Nelson did not occur until roughly 6 weeks after the class certification motion was filed on his behalf. Mm-hmm. So even if we were to take the city's standing rule as true, they lose. Because as to Nelson, the tender to him occurred after the motion for class certification was filed. Then if I might respond to the question of Judge Rovner with respect to the current policy. First of all, the current policy, whatever it is, did not take place until after the class was certified. Therefore, if the city wants to argue that that new policy somehow moots the case, that would, of course, be a decision that should first be addressed by the district court, where there could be fact-finding, etc. However, the city's statement of the policy here today is not accurate. There is a new inventory receipt that apparently started being issued sometime in December or January. However, the new inventory receipt is itself hopelessly confusing, fails to tell anybody what they're supposed to do in a meaningful way, and we believe we could prove that it wasn't in full force and effect for several months later, until several months after they claim it started. But in any event, whatever their new policy is, it does not include return of the millions of dollars that they're holding on behalf of the current class. The city has in this, if the city's position were upheld, what would happen here is they have conceded that they owe this money to the plaintiff class. They have not returned it. So it seems to me that is basically conceding we don't plan to return it unless you file suit.
Have you done enough discovery to know how many millions are owed?
I could not say with precision. I believe, based on what discovery we have, that it is in the millions. It's probably, my best estimate would be between 2 and 5. And my best estimate would be that there's probably 5 to 10,000.
And how many years are you talking about?
Well, we would go back 2 years from the date of class certification, so it's roughly 3.5, 4 years at this point.
Maybe we can get lower taxes. Maybe
perhaps
we can lower the sales tax.
What discovery produced that estimate? That you said what discovery to date, Peters? How are you able to?
Actually, that did not come through discovery. It came through informal channels and statements that were made.
I thought you just represented to the court that through discovery. Did you mean to suggest some anecdotal information conveyed to you? You're able to represent to the court that they amount?
No, I believe that officials from the city of Chicago have made statements to third parties, which I have become aware of. In addition to that, we do have at least a short list, I don't think it's a complete list, of the number of people. And if we just assume that their claims were even the size of Mr. Nelson's and did the arithmetic,
so you're working off arrestees in the last 2 years. Is that the kind of number you're working off of? And a guesstimate on what their bonds or whatever it might have been?
What the money seized would be, I'm assuming that it's minimal, that it's less than $150, because I believe that the discovery that we have, which is limited, indicates that if it's more than $150, and certainly if it's more than $200 or $250, the city treats it somewhat differently. So all of the claims are small enough that unless there is a class there is no protection for those people. What will happen is there's a giant windfall to the city of whatever the amount of money is, and a de facto forfeiture worked against the members of the plaintiff class. This court has said in an earlier decision, aptly and perhaps colorfully, that once a class is certified, the court of review will not overrule that determination unless there's a manifest abuse of discretion. There was no such manifest abuse of discretion in this case. It was entirely the right ruling. This court has compared the burden that the city now faces in terms of overturning Judge Castillo's well-reasoned certification ruling to a camel passing through the eye of a needle. They cannot meet that burden. They don't even come close to reaching that burden. And for those reasons, this honorable court should affirm the decision of Judge Castillo.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. Mr. Enrique?
Thank you. I want to address Judge Easterbrook's question that we have only offered what we think is due, not what is actually due, and not what was demanded. All versions of the complaint had wherefore clauses stating what the plaintiffs demanded. All versions are in the record. And in all versions, here's what they demanded. That the court enter an order requiring the defendants to return the property seized from the plaintiffs. That's what our checks were. Order the defendants to pay plaintiff reasonable interest from the time of the seizure to the time the property is returned. Our letters address that as well. And then award reasonable costs and attorney's fees. There's no statement that any other damages were requested.
Look. Surely you know from Rule 54B that complaints in federal practice neither state nor limit the relief that's sought. Right? Courts award the relief to which plaintiffs are entitled. In order to figure out what relief that is, you see what the plaintiffs are asking for. The complaint neither specifies it nor limits it.
Well, I understand that.
The plaintiffs are asking for compensatory damages.
Well, that's why...
We know they're asking for attorney's fees, too. But.
Well, Your Honor, that's why we certainly satisfied the demand, as we've argued. In addition to that, those items that they listed in the demand, plus additional things that they later raised. I mean, we can only react to the demand as it's presented to us, and we did submit all of the amounts that were requested in that demand.
Now, if mooting a claim were as easy as the city seems to think it is, the city could continually create unconstitutional policies and then simply avert litigation by making good on the eve of trial. I mean, the purpose of prospective injunctive relief is to keep public officials from treading on the rights of citizens in the first instance. And the city can't moot the claims for prospective injunctive relief simply by giving the plaintiff, you know, the plaintiffs their money and saying, now go away?
Well, once a class is certified, it doesn't matter whether or not any tender that is made after the class is certified does not destroy class action. The class can remain. We can't. Many class actions are brought against the city. Many actions proceed to judgment. Very few of those cases are ones in which the claims have been mooted as they are in this case. To return to Judge Easterbrook's question about the demand versus what the defendants concede that they owe, first of all, you know, to react to the demand, we did send them what they asked for in the demand. It later turned out, in adjudicating the class certification motion, that the questions concerning other consequential damages that they raised for the first time, not in their demand, they raised for the first time. But they did didn't document those, and under the Sabo decision, their failure to document those that meant that for purposes of the summary judgment motion, those no consequential damages were part of the case. Also, I would like to correct one error that counsel stated. He forgot to mention that when the motion for class certification was filed the day after the second named plaintiff, Egan, was added, that motion for class certification was denied. And when the complaint was dismissed, at the time we tendered 2 weeks later, there was no motion for class certification pending at that time. So even under this court's decision in Sussman, this case does not fall within Sussman. Sussman doesn't reach this case. Counsel failed to mention that that motion had been denied. It was only that the second motion for class certification was granted well after tenders had been made, was filed well after tenders had been made. The second motion for class certification was filed well after the tenders were made to both named plaintiffs. And under this court's decision, even the very favorable decision to plaintiffs in the Sussman case, that case doesn't reach this case. We request that this court reverse the order certifying the class and dismiss this case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rakey. Thank you, Mr. Peters. Ms. Solomon. The case is taken under advisement and